From the racetracks around Australia, here's Inside Motorsport.
Hi, I'm Peter Norton. I'm Craig Revell. Thanks for joining us once again on Inside Motorsport. Well, last weekend we spoke about the terrible run the car had at the Lausitz Ring when Alex Zanardi lost both his legs in a crash at the end of the race. The Formula One was over in Italy for the Italian Formula One Grand Prix. Jonathan Ledyard was there to see Juan Pablo Montoya's debut Formula One win in his rookie season.
It took Bernie Eccleston, no less, to order business as usual in the face of a driver's pre-race revolt. But Montoya's first victory in his 15th Grand Prix shouldn't be overlooked in the furore surrounding Michael Schumacher's request for a start line ban on overtaking. Mindful of a marshal's death here last year, Schumacher had wanted to avoid another statistic at such an obviously safety-conscious time. But Eccleston, backing Jacques Villeneuve's stand against his fellow drivers, was unmoved, and the champion defeated, even before Montoya launched his Williams into the first chicane, where Trulli was punted out by Button. Ferrari then fumbled Barrichello's first pit stop, and Montoya's car control did the rest. The absence of champagne was understandable, but the blank look on Ralf Schumacher's face was a telling insight into the future relationship of this Williams pairing. Champion Schumacher took fourth, almost unnoticed. De La Rosa, a key supporter, came fifth, and Villeneuve, of all people, was sixth.
Of course, celebrations were kept at a minimum for all the drivers during most sporting events over last weekend, with the tragedy, of course, of the terrorism attacks on the United States. But in the driver's debriefing, you could tell that Juan Pablo Montoya was extremely happy with his first Formula One victory.
Oh, I'm just so happy. You know, first of all, I think I want to thank everybody at Williams, BMW, Michelin. They've done a fantastic job for me, and just so pleased with the result. Thank you, Juan.
No, I'm not really sure what happened. We lost a lot of time. But you know, as I said before, we would put a great show. I mean, the car was very well. I think Bridgestone did a fantastic job with the tires, and we were very competitive with the engine as well. So it was great. But unfortunately, we lost that little bit, and it wasn't enough to win the race.
Hey, Rubens. Ralf, you achieved fastest lap, but it seems your car wasn't very consistent today. Was that the case?
No, I must say, didn't get it right the whole weekend, basically. We had a few problems with tyres, but, you know, team did a fantastic job in finishing first and third, and that's, I think, it's a great achievement, so big thanks to the team.
Juan, we now go back to Indianapolis, where, of course, last time you were there, you won the 500s. What are your feelings going into that race?
I think it's going to be a very emotional race for everybody, and I think, you know, I'm very happy to go back there. You know, last time I was there, I won. You know, I've got my first one win now. So it'd be, you know, the car should work there pretty well, so it should be quite interesting.
Richard Burns has taken out the Rally of New Zealand in fine style. It now brings him, Colin McRae and Tommy Mäkinen to the top of the points chase in this year's World Rally Championship. From rally headquarters in New Zealand for the BBC, here's Todd Nile.
Richard Burns' win came after a drama-filled last half-hour in which all four front-runners hit trouble. Burns in a Subaru punctured in the second-to-last stage, but a spin by second-place Colin McRae in a Ford kept his lead safe. In the final stage, McRae's Ford teammate Carlos Sainz spun, falling to an eventual fourth behind the Peugeot of Finland's Harri Rovanperä. Rovanperä's teammate Marcus Gronholm crossed the line third overall, but fell to fifth with a penalty for jumping the start. Colin McRae and Tommy Mäkinen jointly lead the Drivers' Championship from Richard Burns. Ford takes the lead in the manufacturer's race ahead of Mitsubishi and Subaru.
Well, victory at Rally New Zealand went to Richard Burns. Congratulations, Richard.
Thanks a lot.
It was an important race for you, and I know that after the last World Championship round, you said you had to win at New Zealand to keep your championship hopes alive, and gee, you went out and did that, as you said.
Yeah, it's been pretty close, Rally. We obviously planned since Friday to make sure we had a good, clean run from the stages, so we didn't go hard and get too far at the head of the field. We stayed right back, made sure we had good, clean roads for both for today and yesterday.
It would have been a change for you to see dry weather out there on the New Zealand roads, considering it's been a quagmire over the last few years.
Yeah, it is. It is different. It was quite dry last year on the first day, but no, certainly nothing like it is now.
Now, you have to head back to Europe before you come back to Australia. Does the travel upset you just physically and mentally to keep changing time zones like you do have to do for the championship?
Yeah, well, fortunately, next year it looks like the two rallies will be back-to-back, so I think there'll be a few people on holiday here and in Australia. So, but certainly, it's not one of the best parts to be getting on long-distance plane every other week.
And, of course, with what's been going on with airline travel, of course, that does that go through your mind at all, or through the organiser's mind to travel around like that?
Well, that's a bit difficult to answer. I don't really know, because I was already here when it happened.
And for yourself now, to concentrate on the championship back to Europe, is there much development work that the team does with the vehicles in between each rally?
Yeah, there's normally around 4 or 5 days testing done before each event, so then we're in Italy in a couple of weeks' time is no different.
Richard Burns, thanks very much for your time.
All right, thanks a lot.
And joining us now is the new guy for Stone Brothers Racing. He'll be partnering Marcus Ambrose in the big one, and that, of course, is Wayne Wakefield. How are you there, Wayne?
Yeah, very good, mate. Thank you very much.
Now, obviously, you're pretty excited about this signing for the big race.
Oh, mate, for sure. Mate, I've been sort of sniffing around the fringes of the motorsport fraternity now to try and get an opportunity like this. And, you know, it's been unfortunate circumstances for Greg Crick, but, yeah, it's happened for me this year. I'm very excited about it.
Now, you've a guy who's been around in the Konica series for a little bit, but you might be a bit of a surprise to other people. Explain a bit of your background.
Mate, well, I sort of started motor racing and club racing, yeah, and sort of progressed up. You know, I got some sponsorship and started in the Konica series in 2000. We finished third in that, and unfortunately we haven't had any sponsorship, so I've only done the one round this year, and that was at Lakeside, and we had a pretty good result there, and I think that's sort of got my name going again, and I think that's why Ross ended up giving me a call, I guess.
And
from the Stone Brothers, that is.
Yeah, and of course, you're in a pretty good position to get a lot of practice at the Mountain this year because you're in the Konica race on the Saturday as well.
Yeah, mate, yeah, we already had some sponsorship tied up to do the Konica race on the Saturday, so I was already committed to that before the Pertec deal came along. So, yeah, I'll be doing both, so there won't be short of miles around Bathurst by the end of the weekend.
And what will it be like having to jump from a Commodore in the short race into a Falcon on the Sunday?
There's a few things we're doing to try and make the cars a little bit similar. We're using the same. The Stone Brothers are giving us some brake pads to use in the VS, so, you know, the brakes are familiar. Apart from that, you know, it's still a V8 supercar, so there's not a great deal of difference
and,
between the two cars.
Now, I guess you're pretty excited about the form that Marcus has shown so far this year. You've a real chance
of
victory.
Yeah, well, that's right, mate. I've sort of been thrown into the deep end. The pressure is really on because, you know, I mean, Marcus is a very good chance of taking the thing out. I mean, Ross and Jim know how to do it. They won it there in 99 with Jason Bright and Stephen Richards. So, you know, they're sort of relying on me to be able to give Marcus the support so he can, you know, hopefully by the end of the day or on the lead lap and in a position to challenge for a win.
And now, of course, you're right that they're a top-notch team, and we saw them on the front two positions at the Queensland Raceway. Have you been practicing your starts?
Well, yeah, I don't know if that same strategy would be employed at Bathurst, being such a longer race, but, yeah, mate, I mean, you know, if they did decide to do it like that, it wouldn't faze me at all. I'd be more than happy to start the race.
Well, pretty exciting times ahead for Wayne Wakefield and Marcus Ambrose as they head towards Bathurst. All the best for the big race.
No worries, mate.
Grant Morrison joins us from the media centre at the Rally New Zealand in the foothills of Mount Wellington. I would assume you are at the moment with, Richard Burns really staking his claim on this rally championship season. He needed to win here in New Zealand to get himself right up in the running, and that's just what he set out and did.
Yeah, he did. He's had about 3 seconds so far a third and a fourth on the championship, and this has really boosted the team's confidence. It was quite an unusual rally in that you might realise we're about a month and a half later than we normally are, so it's dry, and most of the competitors have been used to being rallying on very wet roads, which tends to give them more grip. But now with a lot of loose gravel on top, it was a definite disadvantage to be seated in the front of the pack, if you like, on the first day, because all you were reduced to was road sweepers. But Richard didn't have that problem on the first day. He tactically held back so that on the second day he was probably, I think he was in ninth place, which meant that the eight cars in front of him swept the road clean, and it was like he was driving on tarmac, really, and that's where he made his move, and then defended a 42-second lead over Colin McRae this morning. It got down to 16 seconds at one stage, but then Colin had a spin and they installed his Ford Focus, which left the Subaru of Richard Burns to cruise, really, to the finish line with only about 10 or 15k to go when that happened to Colin McRae. So, yeah, an excellent win for Richard Burns and Robert Reed.
You mentioned about the change in date, because over the last few years, and particularly 2 years ago when you had to close down almost a quarter of the rally stages because of inclement weather, it does seem that David Richards and all the management team now at the World Rally Organisation are thinking a bit more about the trips to the Antipodes, and of course next year we're going to see Rally New Zealand and Rally Australia both spaced in a way where they can either base themselves in New Zealand or base themselves in Australia between the two events.
Well, in fact, that's starting to happen already. In fact, we noted that all of the Subaru cars, there was only one piece stripped off them, and that was the struts. All the whole car except the struts, which are pretty vital to the handling of apparently the cars that they've got waiting back in Europe for the San Remo, all the other cars are being shipped to Australia as is, except for the front struts, which are obviously the ones they've tuned for the cars in Europe as well. So those cars are going directly to Australia from here for the Australian event.
And for New Zealand runners, of course, Possum Bourne finishing once again in the top 20. I don't know if he'd be happy with a top 20 spot, but because he was certainly gunning for a top 10 finish.
Yeah, and he was, and in fact at one stage he got down to ninth on the leaderboard, but then struck a few problems over this last day, which has put him back, you know, unfortunately back into 13th place, but still there's some pretty illustrious drivers behind him that, you know, he would have been reasonably happy to finish the event for a start, because it was a very, very technical event, and that's the way that a lot of the overseas teams and drivers have described it. And, you know, he's come through to, you know, to make it to the end, because a lot of this loose gravel on top just completely changed the drivers' attitudes to where they were braking, how they approached the corners. And it wasn't like driving behind somebody or two or three people who used the same lines. You could be four drivers back, and there'd be four different tracks going into every corner, so you couldn't find a good, solid, hard surface. And Possum suffered with a bit of that, but, you know, still finished 13th in a World Championship event. I'm sure he'll want to do better in Australia.
And was he the first New Zealand runner home?
Yes, he was, which was to be expected. He came in just behind Francis Delacour, then above that was Freddie Leutz, Kenneth Erickson, Alistair McRae, Tommy Menken and Peter Solberg. You know, so he was right up there with the best. Behind Possum was Aria from the Subaru Rally team, the world team. Then Tony Gardemeister was further back. Rudy Stoll, the first group in. And so that was, you know, some of the better cars that were behind Possum, you know, to finish the event, obviously, as well. But he, as you know, he's fiercely competitive and would have loved to have had a top 10 finish.
Mm. Now, what about for the Australians? Did you have any coming over to compete in Group N?
Yes, we did. Well, we had Cody Crocker over. Now, Cody, unfortunately, had a real monumental off, and there was initially a fair bit of concern for Cody and his co-driver, but it turned out that at one stage they thought he might have damaged his jaw, But what it turns out, like, he looked like he'd been in the front row with the Australian Wallabies, and he got a bit of a black eye. So that wasn't too bad. He's out of hospital. He went in there just as a precaution, and his co-driver pulled a ligament in his finger. But it was a decent roll, one good one at high speed. So, you know, and a lot of people initially were very concerned for Cody and his co-driver, but then, you know, now that he's fine, he's okay, hopefully he'll be along to the function tonight to have a beer.
And, of course, as all the drivers do get set for that, crowd-wise, having been marred with wet weather over the preceding years, what was the turnout like for the special stages? And I do know you had a super special stage run under lights as well.
Yeah, well, we did. We ran it twice on the Friday night. That's two nights ago. And it was huge crowds there. And the impression that I've got as press officer when I actually went out to Ruawai on the Saturday was a huge crowd following the event. We've accredited somewhere around about 272 news media, so there's been a very strong interest in the news media in New Zealand as well. So, you know, again, the interest is heightened every time. And as you might know, that you know, we're going to have Tiger Woods over in New Zealand for the New Zealand Golf Open, and a lot of the media are salivating over that, and rightfully so. But we keep reminding them, hang, the rally keeps bringing the 15 of the top rally drivers in the world to our shores, and you get the same over there. So, you know, that puts it in perspective from our point of view.
Mm. And, of course, crowd numbers, were they up?
Yes, they were. I would put a figure of around about 15 to 20%. And again, I think you're right in saying that it is the better weather conditions that have aided that increase in interest.
Now, I know that you do have a website which has a lot more details than we can possibly talk about during this interview, and that is www.rallynz.org.nz, if I'm right.
That is correct, and all the results are on that website.
Well, thank you for your time this evening, and congratulations to all the organisers of Rally New Zealand. It sounds like it just came out this year without a hitch at all, and everyone has had a ball.
Well, and we just wished you all the best for your Australian event as well.
Well, joining us now is the editor of Motorsport News, Phil Brangan, who's had, I think, probably a busy weekend putting to bed the latest edition of Motorsport News. Phil, obviously a lot going on, and therefore a lot of extra hours being put in by the team.
Well, there is, and not only that, because even though Motorsport News and its staff usually flies with Qantas, Motorsport News magazine flies with, well, used to fly with Ansett, so... Yeah, I've just actually been putting in a full day in the office on Sunday. Who works on Sunday?
Hard-working motorsport news editors whose bosses should give them a raise based on that.
And radio stars, I guess.
Radio stars, yes, we like that too. So, Phil, obviously the last issue you had was the wrap-up from Winton and the lead-up to Bathurst. Of course, the next issue, I believe, is going to be even more focused on the race up on the mountain.
Well, we've got a full Bathurst preview. We've actually got 17 pages of Bathurst preview, not just, oh, here's an entry list and here's who might win, but we've got tips from people you would not believe. We've got their Bathurst predictions. We've got all the ins and outs. And, I mean, Bathurst gets bigger and bigger every year. No naming rights sponsor this year. But I haven't got a clue who's going to win. I wrote down 12 cars.
It's getting bad when you've got to pick an even dozen.
Oh, it is a shootout. And it's coming down to who has a good lap at what time, who has a good pit stop, who has track position, and who has good tyre speed at the end of the race. And there's all sorts of tactical things going on this year, and we will reveal all on Thursday.
Mm. Now, of course, there's lots of other motorsport news happening around the world, and no doubt part of it will be the goings-on with Kart and Alex Zanardi.
I don't know how anybody else reacted to the news, but I've actually spoken to some people in kart racing, both here from the Honda Indy, of course, on the Gold Coast, and in the United States in the last 10 days. And because of the events of September 11 and here with Ansett and all that sort of stuff, so many people have reacted so emotionally to what happened to poor Alex, and anyone who's seen the crash would just be absolutely horrified. It's one of those dreadful situations. We have pictures of the crash, but... as long as I'm editor, I'm not going to run them. It's too much. It's too heartbreaking. And, of course, you've been to the Honda Indy yourself. You know what a great driver Alex Zanardi is and what a great guy, and still is. We talk about him in the past tense, but he still is a great guy. And, unfortunately, we won't see his likes in a race car again. great tragedy for the sport.
The good news is he has come out of the induced coma, has been speaking to friends and family, and a couple of the drivers did go and visit him this week, which was quite brave, because normally drivers like to shy away from anything that reminds them how dangerous motor racing is. And they've all been talking about how he's already starting the process of getting fitted for his new replacement legs, and also how that he has set himself a goal to be skiing by the next season. So already they've been able to see that he is on the mend and been able to sort of say, look, he's already got himself some goals.
Well, Wayne Rainey races supercars in the USA with the support of his old motorcycle sponsors, of course, Yamaha and PJ1 lubricants, and he's got hand controls. I don't have any doubt that sooner or later that's what we're going to see Alex Zanardi doing. And it is part of the legacy he's left the sport that drivers, like you say, they normally shy away from that sort of stuff. Everybody loved Alex. All his opposition drivers loved him. And, of course, the other tragedy was that for anyone who's seen the race, he was going to win that race. He was running down Brack. And unfortunately, we don't know what happened. It wasn't cold tyres. He hadn't changed tyres in the last pit stop. And for some reason, he lost control, ended up on the grass, sideways on the track, and poor Alex Taglioni hit him.
Mm. Now, of course, that'll be one of the issues that you'll cover in Motorsport News. What else do you have planned for this next issue coming up?
Well, let's say we've got that. We've got a full report on the Clarion 500 at Sandown, Ferrari win in Australia for John Bowe and Tom Waring. Of course, all those Tom Waring fans out there in Radio Land will just be high-fiving and slapping each other with delight now. What else have we got? We've got a full report on one first win in Grand Prix racing at Monza, and what a way to do it, and what a place to do it. And what else have we got? Of course, a full report on Rally New Zealand, and what a thrilling outcome it was. You know, the four drivers really stumbling over themselves in the last couple of stages, and Richard Burns. We've got the news of Richard Burns' possible move for 2002. That's going to be some big bucks put on the table, whether he stays at Subaru or whether he goes to Brand X. And everything that's happening in drag racing, big news of course in drag racing this weekend, is a curtailed schedule for the summer season.
Yes, but whilst you're talking drag racing, I'm going to jump back in here and interrupt Colin, because great news for Australian drag racing fans. The AutoZone Nationals are on over at Memphis. Larry Dixon is the fastest qualifier in Top Fuel with a 4.58 at 314.7 miles an hour. But down there in 9, the first of the Australians in Andrew Cowan, K&N Filter K&N Automator Dragster, 4.722 at 303.98. He's just running those 300 mile an hour runs off now, just like you know, we eat Sunday dinner.
He does. Of course, you're referring to Motorsport News columnist Andrew Cowan. Drag racing in America, like most forms of sport and motorsport, getting back into the swing after the tragedies of September the 11th and the respect that's been duly paid that process. Andrew's actually been tuning his car out of Connie Kalita's workshop in the USA, and I guess there's not a better person in Top Fuel racing certainly to try and hook up with than Connie, and the fruits are starting to show. And young Andrew, very determined driver, and very, very well thought of in the USA.
Mm. Well, I remember seeing him doing his licensing passes there only a few years ago at Eastern Creek, and of course now he and Dave Grubnik are waving the Australian flag, and Dave Grubnik does seem to be the forgotten Australian over there in the Montana Express Dragster, but he's qualified in 12th, so two Australians in the Top Fuel eliminations for tomorrow.
Well, you know, Top Fuel, I mean, we're struggling here in Australia. It's good to see the Aussies flying the flag overseas, as you say. Of course, Troy Critchley also going well in the IHRA in the Pro Mod class, the equivalent of our door slammer category. So, yeah, some Aussie good news in drag racing, and, of course, in kart racing. Let's not forget that Scott Dixon was born in Queensland.
Yeah, but he is a New Zealander.
Anyhow, Phil, one of the questions, of course, which is probably something that you're going to be looking at, no doubt, in Motorsport News at some stage in the future, is given the worldwide economic blues and the downturn here in Australia, the impact that it might have on Australian motorsport. You see it as being something that, that a lot of teams, and particularly the category organisers, are going to have to look at in terms of the cost of categories to make it more affordable, therefore can get by with lesser sponsorship.
Well, we keep saying that, but no one seems to be paying any attention, and certainly in V8 supercar racing. We have a problem here in that V8 supercar racing by world terms is almost ridiculously inexpensive for what it is. But, of course, we don't get paid in UK sterling or American dollars or Fijian bum jeans or beans, we get paid in Australian dollars. So there are moves to try and reduce the cost of V8 supercar racing. And just have a look at how many cars had airline sponsorship on them, even small sponsorship. People like Brad Jones had both Lauda Air and Kendall. So I guess that is something that's going to have to be addressed. The cost of air travel is going to go up in this country. The cost of security at airports is going to go up in this country. The cost of air freight from the USA is going to go up. So I guess there will be a never-ending spiral of costs, but that's the way motor racing is, unfortunately. If you want to make a large fortune, not to make a small fortune out of motor racing, you start off with a large one.
At least in motor racing in Australia, they're not getting paid in refugees like Nauru gets paid.
No, but it is early days.
Hmm. Of course, with the airline costs rising and problems with security and so on, do you think this will probably lead a lot of the different series organisers look at the timing of events to give teams more time to get from point A to point B without having to rely on air travel and air freight?
Normally I would say yes, but I'm not certain about that. One question mark that hangs over the, and we can't call it the Shell Series because we don't know if Shell's going to be the sponsor, the V8 Supercar Series next year. We don't know if there's going to be a race, for instance, in Perth. There is going to be a race in Darwin, and of course there is the Northern Territory government involved there. So there is some sort of subsidised travel, but you know, everyone put their hand up. V8 Supercar team owners have their hand up, drivers have their hand up, engineers have their hand up, we in the media have our hand up, and so do the promoters and the organisers of the category. So money can only stretch so far, and I really hope that wise heads prevail and we don't end up with something we can't afford. I don't think we're going to go back to the days of having 13 cars on the grid. I can't see that happening, but we need to be careful.
One thing I know that you in Melbourne are monitoring quite closely is the CTEC collapse around their motorsport program, and that has been quite interesting to watch from here, with them now having people on enforced leave and just not extending contracts on a few of the other people who are involved in the GMC 400. Or is it the GMC 400? It might be the Canberra 100 as it was originally programmed, just like Bathurst this year is the V8 1000.
Well, there will be changes of format on the first level with V8 Supercar Racing next year. It looks like they're going to go to a 300-kilometre endurance race-type format. And the reasons for that are quite interesting. They don't have a lot to do with motor racing per se, or rather not in the first instance. I don't know what's going to happen in Canberra. They have a contract. CTEC, of course, farming out the running of the event to IMG. And now we're getting IMG Motorsports more and more involved with the premier category in this country. I guess the question has to be asked, how long will it be before SEL step out and IMG step in?
Is it like having the chicken in charge of the hen house, or is it the wolf in charge of the hen house?
I don't know. I don't know who you're saying the wolf is. I have to work with these people, Colin.
Yeah, some of us do in a roundabout way.
Yeah, well, it's a hard business, but, you know, we'll wait and see what happens in the future.
But really, at the moment, we are seeing that that concentration on management, IMG management, running the major events in that series. Of course, if you look at the last three events of the V8 Supercar season, points events, not non-championship rounds, all three of them are being managed by IMG. Of course, Bathurst, Pokahoe, and then over at Sandown, John Davison has got a deal in with IMG as well. So those three events, which are supposedly being deemed as blue ribbon events, you have a Canberra, Queensland 500, and then something like the Indy. There you've got six races alone. Like, promoters who are going broke, like Lakeside and various other places around the country, really do need to get support from top-level motorsport so they can get people in so they can upgrade, because I know something that Peter Norton, you've talked to me about previously as well, and I'd like to get Phil Brannigan's thoughts on this. In 5 years' time, the government goes, or the respective governments go, we aren't interested in motorsport anymore. The return, as Perth has shown, the Western Australian government has shown, the return is not there for the money we've got to spend. And they all pull out. So you have Northern Territory government pulling out, you have Canberra government pulling out, you have, say, Queensland government pulls out. All of a sudden, you'll see that the championship has to go back to the club-run tracks or the privately promoted tracks, who have gone 10 years without any major income revenue. And what's Tony going to be complaining about then?
Well, that's crystal balling. We don't know that that's going to happen. People in Victoria said that the Grand Prix days were numbered once the government changed. Jeff Kennett was thrown out, Steve Brax was taken over under the Labor government down here. And of course the first thing Steve did was, Mr. Brax, I'm sorry, did was say, we support the Grand Prix. And of course now the Grand Prix has gone and signed a multi-year deal with Foster's as the naming rights sponsor. The fact is, we don't know. There are a lot of good things about street races. They take motor racing to the people, they're good for sponsors, the corporates like them. It's not good for the sport, because they don't pour the money back into the racetrack. And every cent the ARDC ever made out of running Bathurst, they spent on Mount Panorama and Amaru Park. Now, Amaru Park's gone, Eastern Creek is decaying, and Bathurst needs at least $5 million spent on it. And no one's saying, we have the $5 million, we're going to spend it. People are saying, where's the $5 million going to come from? And I don't know about you guys, but I pay tax, and I certainly wouldn't want to see any taxpayers' money spent on a once-a-year venue.
That's our feeling as well. So that means that promoters and clubs who are trying to run a venue, they've got to either find a secondary series, i.e. Procar, that will draw a crowd, to be able to keep their venues in somewhere near a up-to-date system.
Well, I guess that's true. You go to racetracks like Winton, people may complain about the access to the circuit and the facilities there, but the fact of the matter is, the Benalla Auto Club makes money out of its shell round, and every year they have track improvements. This year it was a brand new media centre. Last year it was a new pit lane. So I don't think the days of the permanent racetrack are necessarily dead. I think they're dormant. But we, like I said, we do need to be careful. And I'm not going to point the finger at any particular group that should get us out of the poo, or even suggest how far into the poo we really are. But like you said, Lakeside's closing. Mallard might be next. We rarely go to Tasmania anymore. Motor racing is struggling at a club level, not just in Australia, but in New Zealand and the UK and the USA. So we're following a world trend. And if the government wants to spend $5 million on grassroots motorsport, I don't have a problem with that. Give it to the AKA and CAMS to spend at the bottom end, so-called, of motor racing to improve the facilities for everyone. But I don't see the money. I don't see the point in pumping more money and our money into the top end of the sport.
I must say, in Canberra's government's defence, the Canberra Kart Racing Club is resurfacing the old section of their track. They extended their track to 700 metres, and they are in the middle of a resurfacing program, which I do know are partly funded by a government grant that was issued to them this year. So there is a little bit going on, but as you said, the training ground of Mark Webber is not sort of getting kudos that it probably deserves either.
That's quite true, and people will point the finger at other sports and say swimming gets government money, cricket gets government money, even the MCG has got government money. In Melbourne, I can go to the MCG 120 days a year if I wanted, if I was a fan of cricket and football, which I don't mind cricket, but I hate football. The State Swimming Centre in Melbourne, which is on the Albert Park Grand Prix track, that was built with largely government funds, and it's open 7 days a week for the punters to use. Albert Park, despite the protestations of the Saps with the yellow ribbons, is a much better facility than it was 10 years ago, and I know because I've been going there for 35 years. So it's a fine line, and I'm not sure what the answer is. If I was, I would be Prime Minister or the boss of Evesco. I'm not. I'm just a motor racing journalist. Mm.
But I guess we are in that situation where road racing could end up like Speedway in the 60s. Speedway venues were new, modern, clean. Now, in 2001, we're going to go to Speedway venues, which really are the same as when they were built.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And Speedway and drag racing and karting and rallying and all those other forms of racing do face a big future, a big question in the future. There are questions of security. There are questions of funding. This sport is going to change substantially over the next 5 years. The best we can hope for is to make the odd suggestion and to document the changes as they occur. But right now, I'm not too sure what's going to happen, so let's move on to something else.
Yeah. Well, Phil, I noticed in this last issue of Motorsport News, you also branched down into a new line of activity as a movie reviewer.
Actually, I had a review of Driven written some time ago. I noticed with interest from the vision at Rockingham and the Lycett Spring that it's going to be released in Europe in November. That's brave, because they've read all the reviews on the internet that I've read.
I think maybe it might be a straight-to-video release somehow.
No, apparently they're going to do it in the cinemas. They were suggesting it was going to be straight-to-video. For gritty realism, Driven ranked slightly behind The Great Race with Tony Curtis and Natalie Wood, which which was made in 1966 and directed by that well-known motor racing identity, Blake Edwards. It's a shocking film. It's absolutely dreadful, as I pointed out, and I'm very relieved to know that a number of people have emailed me at work and agreed with my film review.
But then, given that, when you hear that Antonio Banderas has got the rights to do the Ayrton Senna story, you must start to shudder.
I do start to shudder, except for the fact that Senna's sister Viviane is involved as one of the producers. And I know that Sly Stallone said he was going to get inside the heads of Formula One and then kart drivers when he made Driven. But one can only hope that Antonio Banderas will not be given carte blanche to do what he likes with the character of Ayrton Senna in the movie. And I certainly hope he doesn't bring his wife with him.
That could be a problem.
It could be a large problem.
Yeah, the thing is, we were going to have a Inside Motorsport night at the movies, go and see Driven. I think it lasted a week at the cinemas, and by the time we got organised enough to do it, it wasn't showing anymore.
I was in the fortunate position, guys, of having gone to a free preview. I was invited by Village Roadshow to go and see it, and people walked out of a free preview. Dreadful.
It was looking like a shocker, but you're coming off the back of Days of Thunder. You knew that it wasn't going to get better. If you think of motor racing films, you really go back to the 70s when you last seen some good ones, and of course they were Grand Prix and also Le Mans were both two very well done motor racing movies. And then you go back to something like For the Honour of a Gentleman or something like that back in the 30s when they did a midget show, a thing on speed cars, and I think Clark Gable was in that.
James Cagney.
It was Cagney, was it? Yes, because
yeah.
I know the Janey family out of California were heavily involved in that movie.
That's right. Get out of my way, you dirty rat. I'll shoot you. That's what we need. I think motor racing should be more like video games. We need bombs and cars.
Actually, I think Stroke of Ace was a pretty good telling of a story, too.
What was?
Stroke of Ace. Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson and Jim Nabors were all in the adaptation of the book.
Uh-huh.
Stand on It by Stroke of Ace.
Uh-huh.
And actually thinking about it, so that's got us to the late 70s, early 80s, where we can say there was a decent racing movie made.
There's been a bit of a dearth of great motor racing movies, but keep your eye open. Michael Mann is the guy who started to make Miami Vice on television. He made The Insider with Russell Crowe, for which he really won the Academy Award. No one really thinks he was good in Gladiator, but he's making a movie based on Brock Yates' book about the life of Enzo Ferrari, which I'm hoping you've read.
I haven't, because
right.
I'm not a Ferrari man, I'm a Bentley man.
This will be a cracker. This will be a great film, because Michael Mann knows how to make a good movie, and Brock Yates, despite the fact he made The Cannonball Run, knows how to write a good yarn. So this will be worth watching.
Well, I'm sure all the Tifosi out there will be waiting with one eagerly. Phil Brannigan, thanks very much for joining us this week on Inside Motorsport, and we're all probably looking excitedly and eagerly to the next edition of Motorsport News.
Thanks very much, guys. And in certain cities, because we've got all these alternative arrangements to get our magazine out, look for it on Wednesday morning. We might be on sale, we hope. Fingers crossed.
All right, we will keep a good eye out on that one. And just finally, your thoughts on the Clarion 500?
A bigger crowd than I expected. More finishes than I expected. Not the result I expected. I thought the Porsches would walk it. And it's year one. So I think we've got to give this sort of concept some sort of space and some sort of time to develop. But certainly for all the naysayers who thought it would never work, Procar has done it again. It's been a good race. And it's good to see some varied sports cars out there. So I'm looking forward to the next one.
Thanks very much, Phil Brannigan, for your time this evening.
Bye-bye.
Now, you guys have been getting quite a bit of a giggle out of someone's misfortune this week, and I think we better address that on air. Yes, I can see how you find it a bit hilarious, but a little automotive mishap happened to me during the week, and it's actually a very serious and expensive little mishap for those involved. Now, for listeners there who are very puzzled at the moment, it was a workshop mishap. I had my car serviced, and there was a mishap. And I really shouldn't go into too many details because those who were involved in it are working very hard to find a suitable solution to the problem. So it really would be inappropriate to mention any names. But let's just say that the only panel that doesn't need attention is the rear bumper. So that it does need quite a bit of work. Not as bad as it sounds from that, but yeah, there would be a lot of rubbing back and spray painting to be done. But since this mishap occurred, I've been chatting to some people in the auto trade and finding out about some of the mishaps that happen. Things like an apprentice parking a four-wheel drive with a bull bar, misjudging the length of the vehicle and scraping all down the side of a brand new car. Other mechanics who, they're certain they've popped the car into park, jump out of the car
and scratch their head as it drives away on them. So mishaps do happen.
I know of a customer when I was in the game who had a tyre fitted, or four tyres fitted somewhere else, and came back to me to get the suspension check because one tyre wasn't bolted back on. And, but the thing was, it was a Porsche.
Yeah. Yep. You can be very thankful that when it only happens to the family wagon rather than something exotic.
Mm. Well, of course, the other famous one is the usual trick of the owner of the car receiving the speed camera ticket, and they know definitely on that day they weren't driving it, somebody else was.
Yes, that's right. So, yeah, it looks like mine will be off the road for about a week, so I don't have to worry about little things in the post.
Lucky you've got the Daewoo to back up.
Oh, yes, the Daewoo Express will see us through quite nicely. But in light of all of these incidents, I guess what really is the true measure of a good workshop is how they respond to a problem like that, whether there's any fun and games or trying to pass the buck, or whether they just get on and try to fix it and minimise the inconvenience. So these guys, for the moment, are doing the right thing by us. So, but stay tuned in the weeks to come.
If things turn sour, we could have an expose.
Yes. The listeners can share in the humour that you guys are sharing at the moment. So
I think you could check out a few websites like carwrecks.com. I think we've put the story up there already.
I haven't. No, come on, guys. These guys are trying to do the right thing. But really, it does sound like one of those urban myths where you just scratch your head saying, this is unbelievable. It's believable, actually.
Yeah. That's the frightening thing, isn't it? Well, let's look at some other happenings elsewhere in the world. And this weekend, of course, there's the German Touring Car Championship, the DTM. They're racing at Zandvoort in Holland. And it's the former German STW Cup, that's the Super Touring Cup driver, Christian Abt, who scored his maiden DTM pole driving an Abt Sportsline Audi TTR. And a good thing for him, he's actually got himself his first pole. And things looking good for the Audi team there, with the Audis being 1 and 2, with Matthias Ekstrom in a second of the Audis sitting on the grid. Peter Dumbreck is the first, the Mercedes in third, with Patrick Heusman in the Mercedes fourth. Then Laurent Aiello, another Mercedes, rounding up the top five. The champion-elect Bernd Schneider, he's actually sitting down in 14th place after some of his times for the day were disallowed, as they had a number of yellow flags during the qualifying sessions for the DTM racing there at Zandvoort in Holland. And as a result, he got bumped from where he's sitting quite well up on the grid, way back down to the bottom. The British Touring Car Championship, they're running this weekend at Donington, and there Jason Plato has got himself a couple of extra points, getting pole position for both races at Donington, both the short race and the long feature race. As it was at one stage, he had been bumped off pole by Phil Bennett in the Egg Sport Astra Coupe, but then Bennett did himself a disservice by going faster, of all things, under the funny sort of rules that got set up for the British Touring Car Championship. It's how you set the qualifying time that counts. Bennett did the wrong thing and actually literally bumped himself off the front row of the grid by going faster. Strange but true. And as is, Ivan Muller will be starting from second in both races as well. So you're looking at Jason Plato, Ivan Muller there at the front end. Usual sort of suspects. Steve Soper sitting fifth on the grid for the Peugeot, best of them. And interesting enough, the MGs of Anthony Reid and Warren Hughes, they're looking really good out of the box. They're sitting both 6th and 7th on the grid.
This weekend, the kart circus continued, the first time in the UK. Now, these guys, of course, are trying to come to grips with the disasters back in the US and also the very unfortunate accident to Alex Zanardi the previous week. But the show did go on, and British Champ Car fans waited patiently for the better part of 3 days for genuine action at the Rockingham Motor Speedway. The 3 days of inaction were due to a little bit of wet weather and then moisture seeping through the track. And whenever there's moisture on these super speedways, it means we don't get any action. But eventually they were rewarded with a competitive race with a thrilling finish in kart's UK debut, as Jules de Ferran made an outside pass on Kenny Brack on the last corner of the last lap to take the win. So I don't think it gets too much closer than that. It was the defending kart champion's first win of the 2001 season. Helio Castroneves crossed the line third to cap off a great day for Penske Racing, but unfortunately he was later demoted to fourth place behind Cristiano De Matta after the Newman Haas team successfully protested the Penske driver for making a legal pass in the pits during the last round of pit stops. De Ferran and Brack were the dominant men throughout the shortened event. It was shortened due to losing the light. They led every lap between the pair of them. Championship leader Brack led into the second and final round of pit stops on lap 100, but the Penske crew turned in a lightning-fast stop to get their man out in the lead. After the green flew on lap 104, Deference seemed to have things in hand until the lead duo encountered lap traffic late in the race. They came up to lap Brack's teammate, Max Pappas, with two laps to go, and the Italian was able to use his car to momentarily balk Deferrin, allowing Brack to slip by the Penske on the outside and into a small lead. Deferrin appeared to have accepted defeat, but he got a tremendous run on the straight between turns 2 and 3 on the final lap before making that decisive move on the outside in that final turn. He was able to keep his machine ahead of Brack for the run to the line, beating Brack by 0.634 seconds and Cashanevis by 6 seconds, showing that third was a fair way back. So just running through some of the other bits, the win helped Deferrin trim back Brack's championship lead to 6 points at 147 to 141, with Andretti third in the points on 125, Cashanevis fourth on 123. Dario Franchitti is sixth in the standings behind D'Amata with 89 points. So let's just recap what the top 10 was. As I've reported, Gilles Deferrin was first from Kenny Brack, from Cristiano D'Amata. Then in fourth, Helio Castroneves. Fourth was Michael Andretti from Paul Tracy. Seventh, Jimmy Vassar. Eighth, Tony Kanaan. Dario Franchitti ninth, and Uriel Servaa rounding out the 10. And Alex Tagliani, who was involved in that accident last weekend, he sort of backed up, got back to business, trying to keep his mind off other things, and put in a 14th place result, one lap behind. And the Champ Car Series has a week off before getting back to racing in the USA in Houston on October 7.
Mm. Now, one blow or another blow to kart this year, and I've been, quite happily stating the demise of the kart series, which is probably a bit nasty, but what the hell. But the British racing car manufacturers Lola and Reynard are setting out to build chassis for the Indy Racing League Championship as soon as 2003. The companies are providing chassis for Champ Cars, and they're the only two providing the chassis for the Champ Cars now with Penske's demise. But both are thought to be developing IRL chassis that come into force for the new rules that come into force in 18 months' time. The move will come as a blow to Champ Cars, which is coming under increasing opposition from the oval-based rival IRL. Lola has admitted that work is going on with the IRL car and is expected to be ready towards the end of next year. There has been no confirmation from Reynard in their Brackley-based workshops, but Lola says they're intending to run in 2003. A lot of the Champ Car teams are thinking of entering the Indianapolis 500, which is the showpiece event of open wheel racing outside of Formula One, and would love to be running Lolas there. So some interesting things going on. But Reynard has been expected actually to enter IRL ever since the company sold the Riley and Scott manufacturing company, which is based in Indianapolis, last year, but they retained the IRL chassis producing section of that company, and both the new chassis are expected to be running in August or September next year, but completion will be likely to depend on a new IRL gearbox, which is standardised rather than having 101 different gearboxes. Lola and Reynard will join the IRL's current chassis providers, the Italian firm of Dallara and British-based G-Force. So that's not good news for them.
Well, we're still in the US. Of course, NASCAR are getting back to business after having that week off to think about the events in the US, in the New York and Washington. And it was Dale Jarrett who got back down to business on Friday, taking his fourth pole position of the season at Dover Downs in Delaware, as NASCAR got back to racing following the terrorist attacks in America 10 days ago. Jarrett's Ford recorded a speed of 154.9 miles per hour around the one-mile high-banked oval, ensuring his time slot for Sunday's race. After qualifying, Jarrett, currently third in the Winston Cup standings, donated his $5,000 prize money for the pole position to the American Red Cross Relief Fund. And we should note that it's really quite remarkable how generous the Americans and other people all around the world are being, contributing, trying to let these people rebuild their lives. Jarrett qualified on pole for the race at Dover Downs in June, but the 44-year-old from North Carolina wasn't expecting the same result this time around, and he was quoted as saying, "We really didn't know what we had, that we had the car for pole. We made a couple of slight changes. This is one track he enjoys racing at, but the qualifying lap really is pretty exciting." Now, reigning Winston Cup champion Bobby Labonte placed his Pontiac on second position with a lap of 154.8. Dale Earnhardt Jr. was third, and the two Rickies, Ricky Rudd and Ricky Craven, holding fourth and fifth. Kenny Wallace round out the top six. Now, the Winston Cup standings leader, Jeff Gordon, didn't really have a very good run in qualifying at all, hooking up his Chevrolet with a speed of 152.8, and that was only good enough for 23rd on the grid, but that could be good for people who want the series to get a bit closer for the run into the final rounds.
Well, another championship that's heading down in its final rounds is the European Touring Car Championship, and they have two rounds to go with the two double headers of the season at Estoril and Jarama. And to help their main title contenders, both the rival teams Nord Auto, who run Alfa Romeos, and Jazz Motorsports, who run Hondas, will field star drivers and extra cars for the last two rounds. The Honda team, Jazz Motorsport, has recruited former Works Honda British Touring Car Championship driver James Thompson to help Gabriele Tarquini, while Alfa Romeo team Nord Auto will field a car for Brazilian Felipe Massa to help title leaders Fabrizio Giovinazzi and Nicola Larini. As it is, they both are within 29 points of each other, so it's looking as if it's going to be some good racing there. As it is, Massa is the newly crowned Euro Formula 3000 champion, and they reckon he's going to be very, very quick in that car.
And finally, Ryan Briscoe. He is looking set to clinch the Italian Formula Renault Championship this weekend in only his first season of racing, going on to the penultimate round at the Benetto Circuit at Briscoe, age of 19, from Sydney, leads the Brazilian Fabio Carboni by 40 points, 170 to 130. The former karting ace has won 4 of 8 rounds so far, including 3 of the past 4 runs. He also crossed the finish line another time, but was penalised in a post-race technicality. The drivers can score a maximum of 32 points a round, 30 for winning and 1 for pole position and fastest lap. Already backed by Japanese car manufacturing giant Toyota, which is entering Formula 1 next year, Briscoe is set to compete in Formula 3 next year and hopes to be in Formula 1 by 2003 and 2004. So good news, and we do wish Ryan Briscoe all the best for today's racing.
Yeah, and in news from the UK, there's reports that McLaren driver David Coulthard says that he's not looking forward to having young Finnish driver Kimi Räikkönen replace his teammate of over 6 years, Mika Häkkinen, in 2002. Häkkinen's decided to take a year off from Formula One next year and is handing over his seat to the young Sauber star Räikkönen. While the move puts the onus on Coulthard to take the fight to Michael Schumacher and Ferrari next year, the Scottish driver is sorry to see his partnership with double world champion Häkkinen come to an end. Coulthard is quick to point out that he does not envisage any problems in working with Räikkönen, who after a string of impressive performances in his rookie year with the Sauber team, is expected to keep David Coulthard honest with his driving. Now, I suppose there's some of those favours that are owing between Häkkinen and Coulthard over various races that Räikkönen won't have in the back pocket. Interesting enough as well, word that Ferrari has been working long and hard on their car for 2002, and the word is that the car that's been designed by Rory Byrne and Ross Brawn is something that is quite different from previous Formula One cars with a number of innovations. In fact, they say that the 2002 Ferrari will be a leap ahead compared to previous cars with all new gearboxes and other features that haven't been seen on Formula One cars in the past.
Now, a couple of snippets from the world of V8 racing. We spoke earlier with Wayne Wakefield. Of course, he's teaming up with Marcus Ambrose in the Pertec Falcon for the, I can't say the great race, can we? We have to call it other things. And actually, Wayne Wakefield is one of 4 drivers who will be getting sort of a double header racing in both the Konica race, the shortened, the 30-lap race, and there's 23 cars who will be taking the opportunity to get some proper racing miles on the mountain on the Saturday. They'll be having that race before the 15-car shootout, and that's a bit of tradition that's gone out the window, isn't it? It's always been a top 10. It's been extended to a top 15, but the field is so competitive, you can fill that top 15 full of competitive cars. Now, the fact that there's those 23 cars in the Konica race, I think that helps explain why the field for the big one is down 14 cars from last year. So that's really quite interesting to see the numbers dwindling somewhat. And if you add that to the fact they don't have a sponsor, and they'll have a lot of fans who just can't make it due to the unfortunate circumstances for ANSAT passengers, being able to call it the great race is probably not appropriate in this circumstance, that it won't be the event that it has been in previous years. So we'll just have to wait and see whether the on-track drama will help fill that up.
But Triple S coverage, of course, will start at 6 a.m. Sunday morning with, of course, yourself, Paul McPherson, all providing reports right throughout that race weekend.
Yes, that's right. We'll be there to cover it nonetheless, because we think the racing should be pretty good, even though as an event the crowds may be down. And I hope you're not asking for a live cross at 6 a.m. from the track.
No, it's 6:05.
6:05. Okay. Well, when the phone rings, we might actually get out of bed.
Pick the rookie. You can tell the guys who've done this before and leaving it to somebody else to do.
Well, as usual, the extensive resources of this program means that we're bumming it at free accommodation in Orange, so we've got to add an hour to our travelling times there.
The 34th running of the Sandown 500 is in the books. Clarion coming on board as the major sponsor. And for John Davison, it was a welcome return to a 500-kilometre event on your circuit.
Yes, well, the decision to run it, as I alluded to when you and I spoke previously a couple of weeks ago, had been initially discussed when Ross Palmer approached me last year about running a standalone event, and it was at that stage that I suggested to him that he should look at the 500 because it was already a name that was established. It had goodwill, it had an understanding and appreciation by the motorsport press and the general public, I think. And so we put the arrangement together, but really not until mid to late July, which only allowed no more than 6 to 7 weeks to put the whole thing together. And given the calamitous circumstances that occurred in the United States in the week leading up to it, I thought the whole thing ran extremely well, and I know that in today's paper, John Bauer in the Melbourne Herald Sun spoke very highly of the way the event was conducted and the professionalism of it. So all in all, I think it was a great start to the event. Now, to give you an idea, I went through the figures, my archival figures, the number of paying customers I had at the Sandown 500 for the touring cars in 1991, and that was the year that I got about 12 starters, and I only had about 3,500 to 3,000, maybe 4,000 customers in total, paying customers. And I rang Ross Palmer yesterday and said, well, look, Ross, you know, don't be too disappointed if you don't get a huge crowd for the first up. It's a different concept. They have to be conditioned to accept the cars. They're not the traditional Falcon versus Commodores. And the driver pairing, some of them are relatively unknown by motorsport standards. But I would be confident that you did pretty well given the circumstances. And, you know, I'm hopeful that Ross will continue on with the event in the future. I think it is essential for Pro Car, Production Car and Nations Cup that they have an event with the prestige where they are the major draw card on the program with a high-profile event, and it got very extensive media coverage here in the Herald Sun and Age, far more, in fact, than the V8 race at Winton got the week before, a lot more editorial. So that's a good sign.
For yourself, in the history of your running the 500, I think the crowd figure that Procar had supplied was something like 20,000 people over the 3 days of the event. If you can relate that back to the years before it got taken away from you, would that be half the crowd that it was previously, three quarters of the crowd?
Well, one of the difficulties that you've got, Craig, is that there is, you know, generally some enormously exaggerated attendance figures at these events. And it's hard to know, to compare the V8 figures to the Pro Car figures, because you don't know how much spin or exaggeration that Avesco have put on the figures of other tracks. But when I read, you know, that they had 25,000 people at Calder, for example, and I was out there and believed in my experience and judgment, which now, after being a promoter for 11 years, you know, you do get a feeling for these things. I thought it was about 8 or 9. It's a bit difficult, but I don't really think that it's a matter of comparing them and us. They being the V8 supercars, have an enormous momentum in their favour, in that they get a lot of free-to-air television, while Ross Palmer has to pay a very considerable amount of money towards the production cost of his races. He physically has to pay active television to come along, put the races on tape and edit them, and then put them on television a week or 2 weeks later. And of course, a delayed telecast suffers in so far as that the event is well known, it's passed, while a live coverage, or in effect an hour's delayed as it sometimes is, in effect is almost live. So the V8s have got a lot of momentum over the years, probably going back even to the 60s, where the Touring Car Championship was well known and heralded in all the motorsport press. And for someone like Ross to build a new category called Pro Car and Nations Cup and GTP and so on, and these various names, it takes a while to educate people what in fact they are and how good they are to watch. Now, we ran a 500 kilometre event. Every event ran on time. There wasn't one safety car period during the race, which was testimony to the driving standard, particularly given the speed differential between the Nations Cup Lambos and Ferraris and some of the Class D production cars, which is as much as 15, 16 seconds a lap. It's quite considerable. I thought the event went ahead very, very well, and at the end of it, Ross came into my office on the Sunday night and he was very, very pleased with the whole thing. So if it had been badly run and there'd been some negative comments in the press about it, you'd say the thing probably would have a very difficult road to hoe. But I'm very pleased with what went on, and I know he is. And next year, if they can get some more Nations Cup cars, and it's given, say, 6 to 12 months' notice, like, for example, it's listed on the calendar in the next couple of weeks, and it's all systems go, and we're not, you know, still organising it all or wondering whether it's going to happen in July, then you're going to get people that are going to build it into their budget considerations or go out and seek second drivers to bring along sponsorship. I thought to get 40 cars, given 6 or 8 weeks' notice, was fantastic.
It sounds like, from all reports that we've got, that it's going to make some great television in... well, of course, Sandown will be seen this week with the sprint rounds and then next week with the 500 highlights as part of the whole weekend packaging.
Yeah, well, see, there's another thing that was difficult for them, in that because they decided to run the event only in July, they already had a sprint race championship and sponsorship through Century Batteries, whereby they had certain sponsorship obligations that they had to honour. And that meant running sprint races on the Saturday morning for many of the cars that otherwise would run in the 500 on Sunday. That won't happen next year. And that does tend to dissipate the effort of some of the entrants. Should we be concentrating on the Enduro, or alternatively, should we really be concentrating on the sprint race because it's part of our national championship, while the Enduro this year, 2001, is not, but next year it will be? These things all take time. And really, if you turn back and look at the Queensland 500 for the V8s back in 1999, you could hardly say it was an event of any significance. But this year, the event turned into a beauty, and it got a much bigger crowd. And so things grow. If they're well organised, it'll grow.
For yourself, what was the feeling? I know that you had a lot of extra activities on that were also encouraging the public with the grid walks and allowing people in to see the pit lane action for no extra charge. What were the people saying to Davo? I know that in the advertising they said, hey, say hi to Davo and let him know you're glad to bring the legend back. Did people, were people coming up to you that did recognise you and say, this is great?
A couple of people came up to us during the day and said what a fantastic day out it was and how it's always like that at Sandown. You know, the free access to the pits, we had some 300 or 400 cars on display with Lambos and the early model Holdens and the XR6, XR8 owners, and some old Bathurst GT Falcons, looked like Moffat had just hopped out of them, and about 250 utes, and what we call scatter, entertainment scatter, which is all around the grandstand precinct in pretty convivial surroundings. People don't always walk up and say to you what a fantastic day it is, but we've got no complaints written or by phone. Mind you, we never get many, but we've had none. I think one thing that you know, Ross and I tossed and turned about was whether we would open up the full dimension of the spectator amenities at the track along the back straight and around from Dandenong Road corner into the front chute. And the decision was made at this stage that we didn't want to trigger a whole range of expenses and toilet cleaning and security and fence jumpers and all the bits and pieces that go with it if you're going to open these areas. And we had a couple of people ringing up and saying, oh, we're disappointed it's not open. But we did have signs on the gates that said that they weren't going to be open and that the area that they could purchase tickets or come in was via the grandstand. Now, you can't always please everybody. But it really will be up to Ross Palmer next year to decide what he wants to do. He underwrote the event financially, and he would have to do that again. So it's up to Ross. I suppose you're going to have to ask him that leading question.
Well, John, it was an interesting weekend, to say the least. The result has certainly made the Tifosi extremely happy. I reckon Lygon Street would have been on fire on Sunday night.
Yeah, great effort, and I understand that Tom Waring, that owned the car that John Bale drove with him, has received a complimentary card or an email of congratulations from Ferrari and Modena.
Well, that's all for this week from Inside Motorsport. We'll be back next week with all the latest news from the US Grand Prix over there at Indianapolis, as well as our Bathurst preview leading up to the V8 1,000-kilometre race up there. So from Craig Revell, Peter Norton and Colin Ford, good evening.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. Yeah.